session number 11338, Reel 2.
Alec Ingle, Reel 2. Yes, I was asking you, is there any particular operation that's extra vivid for you?
I don't know. I suppose the first one was really the most vivid, because we went in, we met all these 111s, and literally we took them head on. We were spread out and we were coming straight in with Walter Churchill leading us. He, unfortunately, his eyesight wasn't very good, and he didn't see these things as soon as most people did, so he was directed as to where they were, and we all went in that direction, and we met these things, and it was a fairly shattering experience. You'd see these things, and of course you were closing them very quickly, and before you knew what was happening, you'd got a huge aircraft just in front of you, and you were coming straight at it, and we advanced on those and shot and broke away underneath them, and there was a fellow pilot, Jack Fleming, a New Zealander. He lives down here, somewhere in Sussex, and he got hit directly and just was just a sort of sheet of flame. I think he was hit in the header tank, and the next we knew of Jack was in a maternity hospital somewhere in Kent. He'd arrived near that, very badly burned, but it was fairly shattering to see an aircraft just go poof alongside you. But it all happened so quickly, when you were closing at those speeds. You're not talking about minutes, you're talking about seconds. You're there, you fight, you break out of that particular attack. And on a number of occasions, by the time you've come back again, you can't see another aircraft in the sky. The whole thing has passed you by. It moves at a tremendous rate. Even then, with the speeds we're doing then, unless you sort of got back into the battle fairly quickly, or there were a lot of stragglers or something like that, the whole fight could pass you by. If you'd had to dive down quite a long way and get back again, you'd have great difficulty in finding the enemy again, unless another lot happened to come along. But the times I was shot down. Well, at that time, I was shot down twice. We were coming home from having an engagement with no ammunition and that sort of thing. And we were heading back for Croydon, because you generally came back individually, because you got so dispersed when you're fighting. And I was coming back on my own, minding my own business, about 12,000 feet. Not a thing in the sky as far as I could see, and the next thing I knew, I had a cannon shell through the wing, and I dived into a cloud underneath, and whilst I was doing that, the entire windscreen cockpit was covered with black oil, so I couldn't see out of it. And then the prop stopped. And so I decided, the aircraft seemed to fly all right, the controls seemed to be working reasonably all right. So I prepared to make a forced landing. The trouble is, the fields in Kent then had a lot of poles in them to stop the enemy doing the same thing. So it's a bit difficult. Anyhow, I found something that I thought where I could get the thing in. And duly came round and to crash land in this field, and at about 900 feet tried to turn in on the field, and the aircraft didn't turn, and the aileron controls weren't working. So I looked, and I had a hole in my starboard wing, and the two aileron controls wires were sticking up out of it, and of course the whole thing was smothered in oil. because it had hit an oil pipe. It had hit the oil cooler, actually, and everything was covered with black oil. So I had to slide the hood back and let go of the lock on my straps, which enabled me to lean forward so I could peer out to see where I was going. That was not very encouraging, actually, because when I looked out, I saw ahead of me just a row of trees and a railway line in a cutting, single railway line. This was at Balcombe, so I found out subsequently. And I looked at this and I thought, this is an impossible situation. And I watched my knees knock together. My knees literally knocked together until they hurt. Probably only for a second. So I pulled myself together and counted the trees and tried to get one on each side of the aircraft because I couldn't see dead ahead. And jumped the thing over this railway line, literally sort of swooped it down and just pulled up to jump over the railway line and landed in a sort of wooded bit on the edge of a field with a rather pronounced bang. And I bashed my head. And got out of the thing quickly. That was my first experience of being shot down.
Well, were you all right after that? You know, you say you banged your head.
Oh, I just got a cut across the forehead. Mark's still there, actually. I think what normally happened is that we had a gun. You had the windscreen in front of you, and you had a gun sight. Your gun sight, and I think, unless you were strapped back, your forehead, you swung forward and your head hit the gun sight, and I think that must have happened. It didn't knock me out. But fortunately, a district nurse appeared on the scene, drop of a hat, stuck a plaster on me or stuck a bandage around my head, and then, of course, people turn up very quickly when you crash an aircraft. And the next thing I knew, I was transported back to Croydon. You know, back in business again. But I thought, well, that's, I don't know whether that's going to be the first of nine lives or what. Anyhow.
Did your plane go up in flames?
No. Fortunately, it was very good. So the Hurricanes didn't normally sort of burst into flames on impact like that. Those that caught fire in the air were principally because we used to have a sort of header tank of fuel, which was behind the engine and sort of underneath where the actual windscreen was. And at that time, our tanks weren't self-sealing. And of course, if you got a shell in that, it just poured fuel all over the pilots. And that's what happened to poor Jack Fleming. He I think he must have been hit in that tank. And, of course, all the fuel would flood out over his knees. And then, of course, that would be dangerous. But as far as I was concerned, I wasn't hit there. I was just hit in the wing. And it wrecked these oil pipelines so that I got away with it all right. But it's a funny thing when you arrive like that. You arrive with quite a large bang on the ground, and you stop very quickly because your wheels are down. Oh, your wheels are up, you see, and you come to a halt very quickly. And suddenly there's absolute silence, except for just the hiss of the coolant escaping or something like that. It's most incredible. From, you know, it appearing to be all very noisy and all the wind noises and everything else, suddenly there's a tremendous stillness. And you get out quickly because you don't know what's going to happen next. But fortunately, nothing did happen next, so that was all right.
How about your second one? You said there were two, weren't?
Well, that was a bit different. The two of us were coming back, and we'd been somewhere between Margate and Dover. We'd been chasing some people over there, and we were coming back to Croydon, and I don't know whether you know Kent, but there's a long straight railway line that runs from Ashford absolutely dead straight to Red Hill, and then goes more or less straight to Guildford. And when it gets to Red Hill, there are two lines that come up from the south coast that intersect it, and they go up past Croydon. And two completely separate lines. One goes into a tunnel and the other stays out, and then they reverse the situation. So our technique after these raids, to save messing about, we used to find this railway line, fly along until we got to Red Hill, turn right, go up the railway line, jump over the tunnels, and when you saw there was a sort of chalk quarry on the right-hand side, just before you got to Croydon, you knew when you came to the chalk quarry it was time to put your wheels and things down. And you would do that thing and look left, turn left, and there would be Croydon. That may sound a little bit silly, but in fact the weather factor around there wasn't particularly good, and it was before all this clean air business, and the air, you know, you've got quite a lot of fog and cloudy weather, and you couldn't afford to overshoot at Croydon, because just to the north of the airfield were of course balloons, and if you, there was just room for us to have a circuit clear of the balloons. So I had to make sure you mustn't go past Croydon, otherwise you've been to these balloons. But fortunately there were the Crystal Palace towers there, you could see those. And they were a very good indicator. You could very often see the Crystal Palace towers sticking out of the fog. They were a very good indicator where the airfield was. But anyhow, that's a digression. We were coming back with Pessy, and he, for some unknown reason, he was supposed to be guarding my tail, fireman number two, but he was ahead of me. And we were flying along quite happily at about 8,000 feet on our way home. And suddenly there were five large splats on my armour plate. We had armour plate at that time behind us. And these cannon shells hitting me. And it's just like dropping boiling water onto a metal surface, the noise it makes. It's just a sort of splat. You don't feel anything, you just hear this splat. And there were five of them hit my armour plate. And things seemed to be moving somewhat rapidly, so I pulled the thing up into the air, higher, lost some speed, turned the thing on its back, kicked the stick forward, and projected myself out of the aircraft and came down the parachute. I'd been watching Passy, and I'd seen him shot down before I was. I saw him shot down. I didn't see who was shooting him down. I saw him shot down, and I thought, well, he should be behind my tail. What's he doing up there? And the next thing I knew, I was shot down. So we both appeared in our parachutes, and I came down near Hollingbourne on the hills, on the downs there, quite close to Hollingbourne. And it was a little bit difficult because my parachute harness was slack, and I'd come out in such a hurry that it had dragged my harness up over my shoulders and was pushing my head down into my chest, so that I couldn't move my head, nor could I get my arms up to get at the shrouds to control the parachute. And I could see below me a big electric power line when I was drifting down on this thing. Fortunately, I missed it, but then I arrived in a sort of wooded bit at the top of this hill. And I didn't like the look of it very much, so there's nothing I could do about it, because you come down very fast in a 24-foot parachute. And I hit the ground flat on my back, remarkable enough. It just threw me flat on my back and winded me. And I just missed a large tree stump. But as I say, there was no control. But I was quite quite surprised how quickly you went down. You passed the top of a tree and the bottom at roughly the same time, as far as I could see. And then various of the natives came up somewhat aggressively, because they thought I was a German. Anyhow, I managed to satisfy them that I wasn't a German with a few well-chosen words. And I think the army had been watching us. There was a field hospital nearby at Hollenborn. And the next thing I knew, an ambulance appeared and picked me up because I'd got my left leg was full of shell splinters and things. So they took me down to this clearing station and picked about at my leg and then pushed me into Leeds Castle Hospital, which was, I think Leeds Castle was the officer part of the Shorncliffe Military Hospital. And there they patched me up. They decided that the best thing to do was leave all these shell splinters in my leg, other than the ones that were around the surface. So I've still got them in my leg today. And I was in there for, I don't know, about a week, I think. And then went back to the squadron, but I couldn't fly because I'd got to have a medical. So I had a few days leave, came back, had a medical, and all they asked me to do was stand on one leg. And I managed to stand on my legs and back to the squadron. But I think that was terrible. It was, oh, there were all sorts of funny incidents. This friend of mine, Passy, who was flying with me, unfortunately he's dead now, he was a rather extrovert sort of character with a large dog called Havoc. They're a rather curious pair, but anyhow, poor old Passy, he was flying around one day and he was shot down. And he arrived on the ground in something of a hurry. And when he was found with his aircraft, he was sitting in a seat, and the aircraft, bits of the aircraft were scattered for hundreds of yards around the place. But he was perfectly all right, sitting strapped in his seat on the ground. But he had the luck of the devil, I think.
Yes, I was going to ask you, about your casualty rate. Was it very high?
Well, we lost... I worked it out between us going to Croydon in September and leaving in December. We had 16 pilots killed, but I added the number who'd actually been there through the squadron, and it amounted to nearly 100, because we were getting pilots going out to other squadrons, we were like pilots coming in, we were getting new people coming in, and if at that time, if after about their first flight they didn't look as though they'd be able to cope satisfactorily, we used to get them posted away for more training. Oh, that's the way it seemed to work. So we had a lot of people going through the squadron, but we actually lost, I think, about 16 killed. There were about, you see, the normal complement would be, what, 20, 24 pilots? We used to fly 12 aircraft normally, and we had in the squadron about... 16 and a couple of reserves, aircraft total. But then, of course, some were always being maintained.
Did you think of this period, particularly up until July till September, and the operations you were involved with from Croydon, did you think of it as a battle for Britain?
No. It never crossed anybody's mind that this was anything other than a battle. I mean, it was something... We had to keep going. I think that was the important thing. And it was quite staggering, really, how we did keep going. Because as we lost aircraft, the supply system was good and new aircraft would be flown in. And, the organisation, I have nothing but admiration for the way the organisation, somebody had done an awful lot of thinking. Because these civilian pilots would fly the aircraft in, and then our ground crew would do what they had to do, and off we'd go. You weren't conscious of the fact that there was anything extraordinary going on. I mean, this was air fighting, and that was it. That it was of some enormous significance, I don't think crossed your mind.
How about Churchill's speeches? Tribute.
It was all good stuff, and, of course, all very encouraging. And people were very good to us. People were very good to us indeed. But we're a pretty extrovert lot, you know. Fighter pilots are a very extrovert lot, a very arrogant lot. And we were young, well, relatively. But no, this is the surprising thing about it. People say, "Oh, this terrible battle! You know, it must have, you must have known, you know, how significant it was." I don't think it registered. You didn't. There was no time. I mean, there was no point in occupying your mind about that. Certainly, as far as I was concerned, I wasn't a great character for going out on parties, though we used to go and have squadron parties every now and again in the Greyhound at Croydon and places like that when funny moments, because everybody was pretty exuberant, you know, when you were standing down, we all piled into whatever transport we could lay hands on and went down to Croydon. On this particular occasion, Walter Churchill was leaving the squadron, and we were sort of dining him out. So we set off for Croydon, and when we got there, there'd been a raid on Croydon, and on the town. And we passed, I think it was the British Home Stores, which was blazing, and there's funny little things that stick in your mind. It had little panes of glass in its windows, you know, above the main shop thing, and they were coming out like machine gun fire, these little panes of glass going bang, 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 bang. And we got to the Greyhound. We parked the car somewhere close by and went into the pub, and we were eating there and enjoying ourselves, and suddenly there was another raid, and there was a devil of a big bang, and we all, the entire squadron, suddenly disappeared under this table. It was the funniest sight. Nobody said anything. Everybody just went underneath the table. What that would have done, I don't know, because we're on the first floor. Anyhow, that was fine. We had quite a reasonable party, and we came back to the car, and we parked it. I think there's a town hall or something there, quite close to the Greyhound, just off the high street. And there are sort of plane trees on the approach to this, and we'd parked the car here, and we looked, and there was a landmine swinging from one of these trees. So we got in the car rapidly and retired. But of course it was all very interesting. You had to go out with your tin hat, because there was more or less, when anything was going on, there was a continuous hail of shrapnel from the guns coming down. Quite large lumps of it too. It got quite dangerous at times, and so it was wise to have a tin hat. But then again, some silly things. My sister was down in Tunbridge Wells. She was a dispenser of medicine, and I took one afternoon off and went down to see her when we were stood down. So I went down to see her and came back, and I arrived back on, I don't know which railway station is in Croydon, I don't think it's Croydon East. Anyhow, I arrived back at this station, and there was a devil of a raid going on. So I took shelter underneath a glass canopy outside the station. Like a fool, never occurred to me. There was some cover over my head. I looked up, it was a glass canopy. But perhaps not a very funny incident, but funny little things stick in your mind.
Dowding, of course, he was at the time, wasn't he, and has since been criticised for his strategy in, let us call it, the Battle of Britain. But, you know, what did you yourself think of this at
the
time?
You won't find a single Battle of Britain man. Well, perhaps that's not right. There were one or two renegades, I think, but everybody had the absolute admiration for that man. He was terrific. And very quiet, and he met him the odd time, very quiet, very unassuming man, very sincere man, and very thoughtful man. And he, we collect enough money to raise a statue for him. That was the feeling, you see. There was a certain element, not an 11 group, which was our group, with Park, the New Zealanders, our AOC 12 group was, my God, I've forgotten the man's name. Anyhow, with Barda and his wing and that sort of thing, they said we should be adopting different tactics. They wanted to form great masses of aircraft and intercept with great masses of aircraft. The only trouble was that by the time you'd collected your great masses of aircraft together, the Germans had been and gone. And so there was a tremendous argument about this, but the normal run-of-the-mill Battle of Britain pilot has nothing but admiration for Dowding and the tactics he adopted, and I think there's no two ways about it. He was brilliant. No two ways about it. And Park, our CNC, was our AOC at 11 Group, he was first rate. You'd be flying around and a lone Hurricane would come and join with OK-1 on the side of it. That was Park's personal aircraft. He'd come and see what you're up to, join in and drop back in the squadron afterwards, have words with you. No, first rate. No, I think the RAF... It's the RAF organisation that made the whole thing work. They'd got the pilots. We may not have been the best trained pilots. We undoubtedly weren't. But they'd got the pilots, they'd got the aircraft organised, must have been organised before the war. You saw all these shadow factories and things. We were kept supplied. We were really well looked after. There's no two ways around it. We were, because we were a pretty insufferable bunch at times. But
this ops room that you have referred to, what was that very important? You know, the fact that... you were actually getting the information where the planes were and details through the radar.
It was critical. Mm. You see, you couldn't really afford to put aircraft up and keep them hanging about up there on the off chance that something came in. You'd need, thousands and thousands of aircraft to do that, to maintain standing patrols. At times, though it was a bit later on, we used to maintain some standing patrols when it was thought aircraft might be coming in, but normally it was a response to something that was there. And of course the fighter command ops room had all the radar information where these raids were coming from, and they could estimate roughly the size, and that was passed down to the group ops room, and the group ops room passed it to the sector ops room, and the sector controlled you. And this was Kenley. Kenley used to control us. And the controllers were normally pilots at that time. They were normally pilots who were being rested or something like that. And they used to indicate where these aircraft were and try and vector us in the right direction for them and that sort of thing. But without that control, it would have been very hit and miss. Oh no, I think it saved the day. Is what I say. The Air Force have got it organised very effectively.
What was your opinion of the Luftwaffe?
They seemed to be a very competent crowd, and no doubt about it, they've got some good airplanes. I mean, that 109, it was a good airplane. It probably could outperform, I think it undoubtedly could outperform a Hurricane, because a Hurricane was a little bit stodgy in comparison. I mean, we had 8 guns, they had a few guns and a cannon. And I think if we'd have had better armament and better training, we'd have produced a better result. In fact, a much better result. But I think exactly the same applies to the German Air Force. So, you know, you can't have perfection. This is what we had, and had to make best use of it. But I think everybody had considerable respect for the German aviators. You know, they were doing their job, and they were doing it pretty effectively. I don't think there was any question of the Germans running away from what they had to do. They seemed to press on and do it. I think they should have won, really. They were a considerable disadvantage, because we were fighting over our own country. If we were shot down, God willing, you had a parachute or something, you were back, in your own country. Whereas if they were shot down over here, they were They were a bit poorly placed, but...
Were people ever shot at while they were bailing out, you know, descending?
Well, you heard lots of stories of this. I never experienced anything of the sort. I don't think anybody would bother. You see, what would be the, you'd have to have a nasty little mind to even bother to go and do that sort of thing. You were more, it was the aircraft you were after. You hear stories of it, and there are perhaps some people who did that sort of thing, but and you did hear, you heard these stories, but I don't know whether there's much truth in them or not.
Well, what was the policy of the RAF? You know, were you ever given any instructions about Germans bailing out?
No, not at all. I don't think anybody would take much damn notice if they had been given instructions, quite frankly. It just doesn't seem reasonable. When you're fighting that machine.
Is that so?
Well, yes, I mean, it's your survival. You're fighting to stop that man shooting you down. And it becomes a very...